Welcome to the 34th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
And as Tatenda Taibu gives up cricket for God, welcome to the podcast where cricket is still the one true religion.
And you wouldn't believe how many times Andy had to practice saying Tatenda Taibu before he got that completely right. But it's been particularly nice over the last couple of weeks to be worshipping, particularly the altar of Aussie bashing, which isn't something... Well, it's something we've become more accustomed to over the last few years. But particularly with Peterson's retirement from one-day cricket, I think there was a kind of feeling about how this was going to impact.
But I think accustomed is exactly the right word. I think what was extraordinary about this is it wasn't a shock. No. We were beating Australia, we were beating them comfortably, and it felt utterly routine.
And so the fact that this was the first time that England had beaten Australia 4-0 in a one-day series actually came as a bit of a surprise to me. I thought we probably would have done at some point, if not recently. I mean, we've beaten them by more than that in Test series. So... But no, actually, we haven't beaten them by more than that in Test series. It feels like more than that in Test series. But yeah, what's particularly nice is that with Peterson apparently out of the picture until this morning, the dramatic U-turn, the confidence that's come into the England side, Bapara suddenly has sort of seemed to have come of age. And then some of the selections that in the past might have looked a bit like desperation, such as James Treadwell being brought in, have actually been done with a lot more conviction and have worked a lot better.
I wonder if Bapara, I mean, do you feel he may have had his Ian Bell kind of moment? You know, we've always felt Bapara had the ability but not the mental strength. You think
exactly.
He's had his breakthrough.
Well, and similarly for Ian Bell, he just goes from strength to strength. And there's a real
bump. And this Aussie side, for all the hype of the kind of young seamers and stuff, I mean, not that exciting, were they, really?
And I think the other problem is simply that their batting is just less.
Well, Stephen Smith at number six, the idea that that's a balance.
Is worrying, so it's an interesting time. But just as... Peterson has made his way, apparently, perhaps, out of the international one-day form. There's
Chris Gayle
has come back in.
This made me really happy. I think Chris Gayle has been by far the dominant 2020 player over the world over the last few years, and he's been succeeding brilliantly all over the world for a variety of oddly named sides, you know, in the IPL, the BPL, the KFC Big Bash League in Australia. He's been succeeding everywhere, but not for the West Indies. And it's fantastic to see him back, and brilliant to see him instantly contributing against admittedly quite a mediocre New Zealand side, but he's been scoring well at the top of the order, and suddenly with him there, the whole Windies side takes on different proportions. I think it's really, really exciting to see him back. Cricket here could not have been further from the sort of the son of Kingston. I've decided to label this summer the summer of discontent, because I'm starting to wonder whether it will be possible to watch live cricket. I think I've now maybe three, possibly four attempted to set a day, attempted to set a time to actually go and watch cricket. And the weather is sort of brutally sabotaging
the
season.
Well, it's a combination of the fact that it's so difficult actually to get tickets to Test matches. Mm. Unless you're willing to fork out significant amounts of money.
Yeah.
Yes, there's a great summer of Test cricket coming up. But if you want to, I mean, we've tried a couple of times to go and watch things, and as you say, just being completely sabotaged.
And I just wonder, there is a story that hasn't, I think, been fully explored here, which is that a lot of the counties have been in real financial difficulty over the last few years. You know, some better documented than others. And I think I don't think anyone's quite clear how bad the damage is going to be here. I mean, a good example being Edgbaston and Warwickshire. You know, they lost two, possibly 3 days, I think, of the Test, the England West Indies. They lost their one day between England and Australia. They've lost nearly all of the current county championship games being played there.
And with the really rapid financial turnover of some of the counties, these short-term impacts.
Well, frankly, there aren't many big games every summer, are there?
No, they're not. And also, I mean, these counties don't have huge financial reserves to fall back on when they can't get the gate receipts, which are necessitated by having long days of sun.
No, and it will be really interesting to see how that plays out. I mean, away from the sort of inconvenience of rain, there was a real tragedy at Taunton.
There was. Mark Boucher obviously hit in the eye in a freak accident. By the bail, and his career very much, well, you can't really say it's been cut short because it's been pretty lengthy. But I mean, it's a nasty thing to happen to anyone, and it's also annoying. Well, annoying is probably the wrong word, but I was looking forward to a sort of farewell tour.
It's sad. He deserved the farewell tour. He's one of those players who I've always liked for excellent keeper, very solid and very sort of gutsy batsman. But also very understated, ego. And I think Graham Smith used sort of similar words, describing him sort of as a warrior. I just, on the incident itself, I've just never been aware of anything like this happening. You know, no. It's such an odd, a freak accident is the right word. Yeah. You almost think, well, why doesn't this happen more often? Yeah. It seemed like such an odd thing for the Bale to sort of enter. And the injury is clearly very serious.
There was a criticism that he should have been wearing a helmet, but someone pointed out that when there's an accident that's that much of a freak, then it'd probably gone through the helmet anyway. I mean, it's just one of those complete one-offs. But he's one of those people that I think for us and for our generation has sort of been there all the way through our Test cricket watching career. And I certainly remember the 2004 South African tour of England and his various two things. One, which was his very, very nearly hanging on in the Trent Bridge Test, which England actually went on to win and to square the series with the bat. And then keeping to
Paul Adams,
the frog in the blender, who absolutely no one could read. I mean, you could hardly see where the ball was coming out of his, where his hand was, let alone where the ball was going to go. And yeah, it's just a very sad story, I think.
From the archives, and this week, Toby is going to tell us about some famous cricketers away from cricket.
So this is inspired by Senator Taibu's decision to retire from cricket and to work full-time for the church, which was surprising for a couple of reasons. One of them slightly cynical, which is that in the 21st century, you always think that all cricketers and all professional sportsmen are driven by greed and glory, and so it seems slightly incongruous that someone's been pursuing a career in the church at the same time. But perhaps more interestingly and more sincerely, because we don't really think or have many examples in the 21st century of cricketers who do things very seriously outside cricket. I had an example from a very early age of someone who did do several things outside cricket, Ken Taylor, who I grew up in North Norfolk in the middle of nowhere, and he coached me cricket, and he also coached me football, and he also taught art, and he was pretty good at all of them. He played for Yorkshire and England at cricket, for Huddersfield at football, when Huddersfield were fairly major.
When Huddersfield
you'll know
force,
better than I do, but I think they were in the Premiership back in the 50s. And he was an artist educated at the Slades, and he's illustrated lots of books by the likes of Stephen Chalk. And he was a real sort of polymath, and some people sort of blame him for doing so. Michael Parkinson said of him, his fault was that he shrugged off the gifts he was granted as if perturbed by their abundance. He had it in him to be a permanent fixture in the England cricket side, which I think is quite a sort of 21st century attitude that, you know, you should concentrate on one thing and excel on another. Taylor had an attitude which was much more what we would define as sort of amateur in inverted commas. He says, I might have done better if I hadn't done so many things, but I've been a very lucky man. I've had to work hard, but I've always enjoyed what I've done, so it's never felt like work.
It's interesting that you use the word sort of amateur with inverted commas, because, you know, within cricket, it's often been a great compliment. I mean, I find that Ken Taylor sort of story, it's very inspiring, you know, someone who had all those talents. I suppose, from the Parkinson perspective, there is this sense that maybe sometimes you are best off sacrificing something to get to the top of something. But then I suppose it has to come down to the individual. I mean, you know, Ken Taylor. I mean, he was obviously happy with the decisions he'd made.
Yeah,
he felt he'd...
Exactly.
And led a much more diverse life as a result.
And often it is very, very rare. I was flicking through other examples of other international cricketers, people who really succeeded at cricket, and looking at the other sports that they played. And there's not really anyone who really, really succeeded at more than one sport. C.B. Fry is the example of someone who did, who was an extraordinary figure who I'm sure will come back to at some point. But Dennis Compton, who played for Arsenal and played some matches for England at football, averaged 50 with the bat. Jeff Wilson, the New Zealander, was a famous rugby player and played a few One Day internationals against Australia, but was never very distinguished. Jonty Rhodes, obviously South African, played some hockey, but didn't really make it in hockey. And then Bill Alley was actually supposed to be a very fine boxer until both his cricket and his boxing careers were ended and it's something that you always think might happen, but hope doesn't. When he was batting in the nets and a ball came through, someone hooked in the next door net and it came through and fractured his head. He wasn't wearing a helmet and was looking the other direction. But it's very, very rare for someone to actually be properly succeeding in more than one sport.
You're right. It seems that in every case, one sport is sort of preeminent. And I guess just thinking of the example, I guess I feel like I know there's someone like Jonty Rhodes who inevitably reached a point in his career where he was forced to choose.
Yep.
I mean, I suppose that the luxury of being able to kind of pursue both simultaneously has kind of gone. I think there was an interesting example, Andy Gorham, who is a Rangers goalkeeper and a Scottish international goalkeeper, and he was eventually banned from playing cricket. You know, he was involved at a very high, high level within Scotland cricket, and he was eventually banned. And it got to a stage where the wages he was earning with football, he could not allow to, the risk of an injury just couldn't be permitted.
And similarly, and I mean, another thing that is sort of a bit from a lost age is people who didn't. Cricketers who didn't play other sports but sort of did other things altogether. There's a remarkable chap called Kenneth Gandar, completely unpronounceable name, Kenneth Gandar Dower. And there's a very interesting article on Crick Info by Stephen Lynch about him, and he says this: later he became an aviator and an explorer, and in 1937 returned from Kenya with a dozen cheetahs intending to race them on greyhound tracks. He had some success, although the animals, while fast, were not inclined to chase the hare. Gandar Dower, who a few years earlier had demolished the famous Australian tennis player Harry Hopman, caused a stir when he strolled into the club bar there accompanied by a cheetah.
I think the tragedy is we're just in an era
where that kind of stuff just doesn't happen.
I know,
anymore.
It's disappointing. I mean, it's this sort of spirit of adventure, isn't it?
There are all these stories about the old Nottinghamshire captain, Arthur Carr, in the 30s and 40s. He was Harold Larwood's captain. And he was... You know, at the end of a day's play, he would just go on a massive bender in the local pub, and then the next day get off to his sort of stately home somewhere and spend there.
It's fascinating, though, because it's a complaint you hear. I mean, it's a complaint I get from my dad about modern cricket, saying that, and it's actually all sports, I've heard it, there are not enough characters. There aren't enough characters. And what I wonder is if perhaps, I mean, that is a wonderful example, that Gandar Dower. And I just wonder if maybe we're being a little bit unfair on some of our modern cricketers, because they're not permitted to have such a lifestyle. No, they're not capable of it.
Exactly.
You know, to become a character in that sense requires a freedom that no modern sportsman could really enjoy.
I think one of the very important things here is that in an amateur era, all players had their winters free, which they don't now at all. And so people were able to cultivate completely separate careers.
And I mean, I wondered to an extent what... where cricket would rank in some of these people's priorities. And so that, you know, they could, for example, still be excellent at it, but still treat it as sport, you know, treat it as a hobby, not treat it as the kind of core
exactly.
of what
so,
they do.
So one final example, Syed Anwar, the batsman, was Pakistani batsman, was a software engineer and always thought of that as being his primary thing,
career.
And he played cricket very much on the side. So I think it definitely is... a real reflection of the way that, you know, the professionalism has very much changed the game and has very much, in a sense, narrowed the perspectives of quite a lot of cricketers.
And I suppose you never know. Like someone like Ken Taylor, who's actually had the opportunity to explore all these opportunities, all the abilities that he had. I mean, I wonder how many people there are now, maybe not just in cricket, but in other professional sports, who have been forced to sacrifice, you know, these other abilities,
well, exactly,
these other
when
designs.
You think of someone like Herschel Gibbs, who, and we have a mutual friend who knew him when he was younger and said he was the most amazing rugby player, runner, a hockey player at the same time. And obviously those skills are there. It's just they're sort of, everything's narrowed down so rapidly.
As you know, there is a lot of problems in the world today, you know. In everywhere, there is a complex fighting, you know, and injustice things is happening. The solution of all the problem is cricket.
So, to the book review. In this episode, it's not actually a book review, it's going to be a film review. We are looking at the 2010 film Out of the Ashes, which follows the amazing rise of the Afghan cricket team from, as the film itself proudly says, from refugees to the world stage. It follows through from these players learning cricket in the refugee camps of Pakistan, where they're predominantly sent after the
Soviet invasion
by the Soviets, through various tournaments in Jersey, in Tunisia, and
Argentina.
To qualification for the ICC World 2020.
There's an incredible bit of... I mean, it's interesting. When this documentary began, they could not have hoped to have quite the wonderful story they ended up being able to tell. Because I was thinking about this, watching the film, I was thinking, it's not difficult to envisage this all going disastrous.
The whole thing
a
having
very
been a flop. The filmmakers deciding to make it, going out there, doing the first thing, then falling at the first hurdle.
I mean, it would not have been a surprise if they...
Film.
So the tournament, this video, very early on, the first tournament they go to is the World League Division 5, where they're competing with such heavyweights as Jersey, Singapore,
Japan.
And it's not difficult that, you know, they could have lost at that stage. I mean, it's an interesting documentary from lots of perspectives. I mean, I think from a cricket fan's perspective, there's something really compelling about the naivety of the side. And I mean that in a really positive way, not in a like sort of patronising way. You see big cricket teams today, and the idea of international travel is kind of a real burden of the job.
Yep.
For these guys, it's an adventure. It's an incredible adventure. And I kind of feel like that's going back to more what it always should have been like. You know, an Ashes tour for a young England player 60, 70 years ago, it was exciting. It was thrilling.
There's a real sense of anticipation before anything that they do in cricket, whether it's playing a match, whether it's touring, whether it's anything else. And one of the quite disappointing things is that very early on in the film, and it's interesting that you say, when you say naivety, you immediately said, and you don't mean it in a patronising way, because very early on in the film, they get a chat from the British Embassy in Kabul along, and he says this. He says, they play cricket the way that they play cricket like war. They judge themselves on how fast they can bowl and how hard they can hit the ball, which means that they will do well against teams like Qatar. But when they came up against a team with some decent spin bowlers, they're going to get stuffed. And this chap's sort of guffawing into
it. He is hilarious. He's hilariously patronising.
Very, very smug about the whole thing. And it's kind of quite easy in, you know, we're so used to, I mean, we were just talking about it, that, you know, cricket being such a sort of serious and professional thing. It's quite, in a sense, it's quite easy to forget how beguiling it is for people to be quite so enthusiastic about the game.
I mean, a lot of the film is about watching the team kind of be forced into professionalism, sort of be dragged through it. And actually, there's a very sad sort of undertone to the film in a way. Taj Malik, who's, I think, in many ways the star of the film, the very charismatic coach, always interesting to interview, and obsessed with cricket, you know, such a passionate... Afghan cricket is his life, quite clearly. He guides the team to triumph in the World Cricket League 5 in Jersey and is then sacked. The decision made on the basis that he hasn't played cricket at the highest level, and they bring in Kabir Khan, a former Pakistani Test cricketer. His sorrow after that, you know, his sorrow and his anger actually as well, when he says, you know, if I was in any other country, they'd praise me, now they're sacked. You know, is really quite moving.
There are extremes of emotion that move throughout the whole film, I think, and the reaction to every single victory
is extraordinary, isn't it?
Complete elation, and the reaction to every single defeat is utter dejection. And there's something really, I mean, the film, towards the end of the film, at the beginning, they use their, presumably, a sort of Afghan motto, which is, pull up your sleeves, come onto the streets and start dancing, because happiness is rare in a poor man's life. And you get this sense, particularly when they go back after they've been to Argentina and been successful there, or been nearly successful there, but gained one day international status, and they come back, and just the elation on the streets that you see, and there's a fantastic, they go on a parade through, it seems to be kind of in the middle of nowhere in the mountain, and there's this chap who's just kind of firing an AK-47 into the air in celebration. This is going to end badly somewhere, but just the real sense of elation.
I think it's interesting because we've become increasingly sceptical of this idea that sport can be a force for good. I think, I mean, we as a nation, it's like you know, witness the scepticism around the Olympics coming to London. You look at these images for a country that's been through so much. I think if you watch this film as a non-cricket fan, as well as getting an extraordinary story, you get a very upbeat picture of Afghanistan that you'll never see anywhere else. Yep. Like, you know, you can watch grim documentary after grim documentary of Afghanistan. This is about an Afghanistan full of energy, of hope, of optimism. An Afghanistan that's ready to celebrate success, and those scenes are lovely. It's also an incredibly funny film, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean,
there are some great moments when they're in Jersey, particularly, and they have. I mean, part of the touring, there's a lot of trepidation about what it's going to be like in Europe and in Jersey. Mm-hmm. And there's a classic moment at the sort of the team tea where, I mean, we all talk about cricket team teas all the time. But they look at the pizza and they say, is that donkey meat in the pizza? And there are just lots of little one-liners as well.
Yeah, well, there were some brilliant moments. And it's seeing them sort of go through that sort of the travelling experience and sort of encountering the unfamiliar again and again. So I think as a documentary for a cricket fan, but not just for a cricket fan.
It is. And I think that, I mean, the last thing I think is that the way it's been produced is really, really interesting because it's been done clearly on a bit of a budget. Most of it is shot on, I would have thought, on one camera. And there's no narrator, so they very much let the cricketers speak for themselves. Mm. One of the things that really impressed me was the fact that so often now you, particularly through sort of sporting interviews, you don't really get the sense of sportsmen as people.
Mm.
Whereas they, exactly as you say, it's not just about the cricket, and you get a real sense of these players as people and of their hopes and dreams. So, to the debate. And in the midst of the wettest summer on record, we ask if it's time for Lords to get a roof.
The idea of rainstop play has always been this kind of almost romantic notion. It's part of cricket. It's what you've got to deal with. When the rain comes, you come off, you know, you huddle around in the cold for a bit, and then, you know, you gather your mental strength and get back on with it. The problem is, it's actually becoming slightly ridiculous in a major international sport to have the game constantly interrupted in this way, to have series ruined in this way, to have major lucrative games ruined in this way. And I think the comparison that has to be made here is with something like Wimbledon, where there similarly was this notion that you had to accept it. It was part of the game. It was how things were done. If you had to come off for rain, players just had to deal with it. And you see what's happened in centre court, and I can't really remember anyone now who's arguing that it's kind of ruined it, that's kind of made the game worse. Frankly, it made it a far easier sport to follow, it's made it easier for the players, and it's generally just brought it up to date. It's made the sport comparable with other sports. I think the main issue here as well is that it's becoming, in a summer like this, the financial effect is becoming increasingly horrendous for a lot of these counties to lose game after game after game. And as a long-term sort of plan, it seems kind of increasingly ridiculous to sort of rely on sort of the English summer, rely on sort of good weather.
Can I just jump in and we're talking the motion as you yourself created it, was it's time for Lords to get a roof? And unless we're proposing playing every single county match at Lords under a roof, then the argument that we can't wreck a whole county summer because of the rain doesn't really wash.
I think you've got to start somewhere, haven't you? We're not. I mean, being practical about this, the technical difficulties are obviously there.
Okay, but being practical. Since, I mean, you mentioned the word practical. Firstly, in terms of practicality, to put a roof on Lords would cost, I would imagine, about the number of washed out days gate fees for county games for probably about 2.5 centuries. You'd also have to rebuild the rebuild the entirety of the ground to make it into a stadium, so that all of the roofs all the way around would level in order to then put a roof onto it. So you'd have to completely, basically demolish the ground and rebuild it, secondly. Thirdly, at Wimbledon, it takes 40 minutes to get the roof on and they have to clear the entire ground. And the roof size of Wimbledon is probably about 1/10 of the roof size of Lord. So it would probably take about a day and a half to get the roof onto Lord. And you'd have to clear everyone out of the ground, which is more
So firstly,
I mean, I'm happy to put practical issues aside, but only to put practical issues aside on the basis that it is entirely impractical.
Let's suggest that technology, the stadium technology evolves and advances. Let's suggest we're dealing with time in 10-15 years time where it is both cheaper and you can get it on and
also
off quicker.
Also a time in 10-15 years time when we can control whether it rains or not, but that's fine. The other thing is with this Wimbledon comparison is that cricket and tennis are very, very different sports, and playing indoors has very, very different impacts on the sport. In tennis, the impact is fairly negligible. in cricket, the impact, the difference between playing indoors and outdoors is absolutely huge. All you'd have to do is look at the weather forecast, say, okay, it's probably going to be played indoors, and you just have to bowl 9 swing bowlers and 2 batsmen, and you'd win absolutely everything. It would change the game completely. And actually, if it's time for Lords to get a roof, if Lords is the only place that did this, the entire complexion, why have one stadium in which the game was essentially completely different to everywhere else that it was played in the world? The other thing is that, well, two other things. Firstly, this summer is, yeah, absolutely, it wrecks things, but it is a complete freak of the summer, and we've lost an awful lot more this summer than we would on average. And lastly, I think that attention is probably better paid to the fact that I always get really annoyed when you go to a there's a light rain shower, everyone goes off, you know, it stops raining, and an hour later the umpires come out and sort of prod at the pitch a bit, and then they take an early lunch, and then they have another inspection, and sort of 3.5 hours after it actually stopped raining, they actually get out again. And actually, I wonder whether putting attention onto that might be more productive than spending tens of hundreds of millions of pounds.
What if you could cheaply and effectively seed clouds in the way they attempted in Beijing? Would you be averse to an artificial attempt, not putting a roof on, but an artificial attempt to change climate conditions around cricket grounds? This has got
rapidly far bigger than we envisaged. Changing climate. I mean, I'm all for playing God. But the problem with the roof is, A, it's wildly impractical. B, it would just change the game substantively, enormously, beyond all recognition.
But put it this way. Would it be a loss for the game as a whole to lose rain as a factor? I mean, do you think that's part of the game that we need?
I'm not saying we need to have rain delays.
No, I mean, that's what I'm asking. Are rain delays a necessary part of the game?
I don't think they're a necessary part of the game. I don't think if, you know, it was forecast not to rain for 5 days of a test match that we should go and all, you know, hire a plane with a sprinkler on the back.
Would you say that dealing with rain delays?
I think actually it is a bit of a part of the game. I don't see why. I mean, you always have to play against the elements constantly, and I don't think having a completely sanitised form of cricket is a particularly good thing. I mean, I agree that it wrecks the game if you have a 5-day test match in which a ball isn't bowled. I'm not saying that's a good thing for a moment, but I don't think we should be scared of having rain delays. We still get an awful lot of results.
I mean, I think you're right to the extent that there's a lot of practical things that probably could be done to improve it. I mean, one thing that I guess has to be considered sometimes is the fact that there's a lot of sort of light rain that average club cricket. Frankly, you could play through it. And
well,
if you argue that it's an inconvenience,
in the one day, the other yes. day, when they could have played through it,
and you argue, well, the difficulty, I guess, comes with: is there a possible threat of injury? But you also have to bear in mind that there is always, you know, a possible threat of injury whenever you play high level sport. I mean, I also wonder, there have been some fairly hilarious scheduling decisions as well. I think it was last year, possibly the year before, where West Indies went to Sri Lanka in a time of the year that was known as the rain season, and they basically played about 2 days of cricket in a three-match test series.
And no one was surprised.
And so cricket can kind of hurt itself in that respect. But I think if the roof idea is outlandish, brave, but outlandish.
I think what
does still need to be considered is to what extent we prize the weather, to what extent we want to keep things natural. Because I think this idea of seeding clouds, for example, is not entirely kind of a million miles away. Would we get to a stage where, to protect a 5-day test match, we would, you know, in a some sort of slightly high-tech sci-fi future, want to influence
but that wouldn't have a direct impact on the game in the same way that having a roof on would
have some impact on the game. I mean, you're fighting England and you're trying to bat through the day, it wouldn't bring about
abnormal conditions that have never happened in cricket before, which is what a roof would do.
Two to the interview, and we're delighted to have our first ever Pakistani blogger on the show, Umair Kazi of the Well Pitched blog. The first place I'd be really interested to start is with sort of the recent successes of the Pakistan side, because I think as sort of an England fan, we were all incredibly, well, surprised and impressed by how good Pakistan were when England toured the United Arab Emirates. And I wondered, well, firstly, has it come as a surprise to you, the Pakistan's recent success, the success of the Test side?
Well, to be honest, the surprise was beating England 3-0. I mean, that was a surprise. I don't think anyone expected that. But you see, over the last 1 year, it's not as surprising anymore. It was surprising when it all started about 2 years back, right? Coming off that tour to England in 2010.
Yeah.
And the spot fixing scandal and Misbah coming back to lead the team. And then there were a few series where, you know, there were draws, there were a few wins. And then, you know, so over a year or so, the team had been quite consistent. So I think the last 6 to 12 months is when the fans have started to expect that we will do well in test matches.
And what would be, what would you offer as the explanation for that? I mean, what do you think led the team to kind of develop into a really consistent test side?
You see, the main thing behind it has been the consistency in selection. The biggest, you know, the negative point regarding Pakistan cricket over as long as I followed it has been that there's hardly been consistency in the team that goes out on the field. The cap, whether it's the captain or the openers or, you know, the makeup of the 11. If you look at test match cricket over the last 24 months, Pakistan's 11 has been quite consistent. It's the first time that we've had, I think, about 16 or 17 test matches in a row where the same opening pair has walked out the bat for Pakistan. That has never happened before, never in the history of test cricket for Pakistan.
Do you think there was a trigger for that? Do you think there was something that actually changed the selectors' minds and said, look, we need to change the way we've done things, we need to stick by a group of players? I mean, was there something that caused that in particular? Or?
No, I don't think so, because it's only happened in test cricket. In one days and T20s, that thinking or that thought process has not come in. So I don't think it was something that was planned. It was just that the openers that, you know, they thought were the right openers for test cricket happened to do well on a consistent basis. And I think Mohammad Hafeez has been a key reason for the success, because he's one batsman who opens in all three forms of the game. So you've got one stable opener that you found after a long, long time. And then the partner that he got in test cricket being Kofi Kumar, making his, I don't know, third or fourth comeback into the team, came back in good touch. And even though he's not been as consistent, he was a leading test run scorer during 2011. So the opening player clicked. Under Ali, who comes one down, has been another major reason why Pakistan has done well, because it's not only the openers who played together for those 16, 17 test matches, it's the top three. Mohammad Hafeez, Kofi Kumar, Azhar Ali, the top three have really done well. And, of course, when a batsman's going well, no one's going to, you know, put them out.
It's interesting, because I'd really agree with you that it's similar in terms of England's success in recent times. So much of it seems to be about consistency. It seems to be about sticking with players, even through sort of minor bad patches. I wondered in terms of, from the perspective of Pakistan cricket fans generally, whether that test success has meant a lot. I mean, within the Pakistan sort of cricket community, would you say test has sort of priority over one days in terms of people's interest, or?
The majority, I don't think so. You know, your classical test, your classical cricket followers, for them, yes, but I think it's still a minority with respect to the general fan following. The T20 cricket has the biggest, largest fan following in Pakistan. One day cricket is a huge lot of fans, and not many fans really follow test cricket. So if you speak to one of the classical fans, I consider myself as a classical follower of the game, you know, who enjoys the test match cricket. The test matches being played in Pakistan, they haven't been played now, but when they were being played, the grounds go empty. Not many people watch it on TV. So, you know, for the slightly older generation, yes, they would consider test cricket, you know.
Do you think if Pakistan become, if this success sort of grows and grows, I mean, do you think more success in the test format will make the test game more popular? I mean, if Pakistan keep winning a series, do you think more fans will follow it?
Definitely. For sure. In the 90s, we had one of the most successful test teams when you had Wasim and Waqar and Inzamam and Saeed Azam were playing, test cricket was possible back then. In a big way.
Because I feel like a similar thing started to happen with India, whereby their test success seemed to encourage, you know, more Indian fans to follow the game. I just wondered if going from sort of maybe the positives of Pakistan's recent success, we maybe turn to something a little bit more negative. I was just really curious as an England fan, what your thoughts on Mohammad Amir was, and basically whether you would like to see him play for Pakistan ever again. What your thoughts as a fan would be on him?
I would like to see him play for Pakistan again. The reason I say that is, one, he has served his jail time.
Yeah.
Two, he's under a 5-year ban right now. So once that 5-year ban is completed, which I believe will be 2015, after that, according to the ICC, the police authorities, the criminal authorities, he is allowed to play cricket. So in 2015, when he's allowed to play cricket and he turns up for his domestic team or his club team and he does well and goes through the process of earning the right to be selected for Pakistan, there's no reason why he should not be allowed back. I believe he deserves a second chance. I do believe he was trapped in a more larger corrupt culture within the Pakistan team. And these people who are caught right now, Mohammad Amir, Mohammad Asif, Salman Butt, Danish Kaneria, all these people are, you know, serving the punishment for something that the seniors committed. Had the seniors 10 years ago had been, punished or banned from the game, had they not been let go of, Pakistan probably would not have had that corrupt culture built into them.
And do you think, because I'm really encouraged to hear that, because my feelings, I mean, I loved watching Amir bowl. I think he's a wonderful talent. And I think it was one of the saddest things at his fall. And I think a lot of people in England share your feeling that it's wrong maybe to say he was a victim, but he was trapped in a variety of ways. I mean, would you say your view is kind of representative? Do you think most Pakistan fans would be keen to see him play again? Or is there animosity towards him?
There is a divided view. A lot of the fans have the same feeling that I just mentioned, and you know what the feeling is in England. But there are many people who say that there's no way he should return to cricket, and that he should not be given a second chance because it would be taking away the opportunity from another player who's been faithful and honest and has played during this time. So there is a divided view.
I guess I could understand that point of view. I mean, I saw in a way, kind of following on from Mohammad Amir, I found something fascinating sort of following Pakistan cricket. I've always found it fascinating Pakistan's ability to produce really quality swing bowlers. I mean, I guess most traditionally, you know, Wasim Akram, Waqar Yunus. But even today, there seemed to be a really effective system for the production of young swing bowlers, where you look to India and India just does not seem to produce the swing bowlers in any such numbers, despite the scale of the game. And I just wondered if there's any explanation for that. I mean, why does it seem to be that Pakistan, with a smaller population, less money to throw at the game, can produce so many quality swing bowlers, whereas sort of India, with greater finances, greater population, seems to find it so hard?
You see, the joke that goes around in Pakistan and India is that in Pakistan, you've got a lot of meat eaters, whereas the Indians tend to be vegetarian.
Yes,
so when you're meat, you've got, you know, the bulkier, the bigger bodies, you know, the conducive pace bowling, swing bowling. And India, you don't. And the funny thing is that the good fast bowlers that come out of India, be it as Zahir Khan or an Irfan Pathan, you know, are the meat-eating fast bowlers of India. So that's the joke. But I mean,
that's really interesting. I hadn't heard that.
But one thing is the pitches, right? I mean, in Pakistan, we produce more capable reverse swing bowlers, swing bowlers, I would say.
Yes.
And you know, the reverse swing comes about because of the conditions in Pakistan. I mean, it's so batsman friendly, and the pitches are so dry and hard that, you know, a lot of bowlers learn reverse swing at a very young age. And was passed on through the generations, you know, Sarfaraz Nawaz, Imran Khan, to, you know, Mohammad Amir and Wahab Riaz and so on. But the conditions have something to do with it. But, it's a real mystery. I mean, for all these years, India has produced the batsmen, whereas Pakistan has produced the bowlers. And although we come from a very similar background and a similar kind of pitches, I don't have an answer.
No, I think it was fascinating. I mean, I find your answer extremely interesting, because I like the idea that actually, because conditions for bowling are difficult, reverse swing almost becomes necessary. You sort of have to learn it. I very much enjoy your blog, and I find it very insightful and very, very thorough. And one thing I felt like I learned quite recently, actually, was about Hamid Azam. Hamid Azam, the young one. And I was very interested because he's a player who has received almost no attention in sort of in amongst the kind of cricket circles I know and the cricket circles I followed. And I wondered if you could sort of tell me a little bit about him and why you're kind of so excited about him, because you seem to see him as a real prospect.
You see, he's a young cricketer. He's 21, 22 years old. And he came through the ranks to the under-19 team. The under-19 World Cup that took place in 2008, I think. He did really well, scored a 90 odd in the semi-final and led Pakistan into the final. And he's an attacking batsman, ideal for T20. And I think he's the right kind of batsman you need at number 6 in ODI cricket, limited overs cricket, where, you know, you can come, you can play attacking cricket and you can bowl a bit. Pakistan's been missing, you know, the balance of the ODI team has not been too good. With Abdul Razak gone, you don't have that person who could, you know, bowl a bit, bat a bit. So Hamad Azam is the one who can fill that void. And he's played a few ODI innings as well, where you saw how easily he was hitting those sixes. You know, it just seemed like a young Shahid Afridi walking out and smashing the ball for six. And he's done it for the under-19 team. He's finished a few games for the under-19 team. He does it for the domestic team he plays for. You know, he's a finisher, and it's something that the Pakistan One Day team needs that year.
It was really interesting, because as I said, it was a name I hadn't heard before, and it was great to know about. It's funny you mentioned Shahid Afridi, because I'd read on your blog as well, and I think you're very right to focus on the contribution Azhar Ali has made. And I couldn't help thinking that Azhar Ali is kind of the polar opposite to a player like Shahid Afridi. He seems such a kind of modest young man. He plays a form of cricket that is actually not necessarily that pleasing on the eye. He's a very defensive batsman. And I kind of just wondered, is there something about Pakistani cricket that means someone like Shahid Afridi will always be the hero? Or do you think Pakistan fans could ever get excited about someone like Azhar Ali?
We're a very impatient lot. You know, we don't like waiting for things. We want things to happen very quickly. That's why all this, you know, drop this guy, get that person, this captain's not good, get the new, another person to lead. So, you know, I mean, that impatience is why Afridi is probably, you know, he is worshipped in Pakistan. He's by far the most popular cricketer. But someone like Azhar Ali, I mean, even in one-day cricket, he's come out, he's played 5-6 one-day games, he's done well. And he's shown that, you know, he can be stable, but as well can be aggressive when the need arises to be. So while his test match innings might be not pleasing on the eye, his ODI innings have been. And there's no reason why he can't be considered the hero. And I think he already is amongst the test ranks. And people within Pakistan are already talking about him being the future captain and him being the person to lead Pakistan, 4 or 5 years down the line.
Oh, no, I'm really glad to hear that he's getting the recognition he deserves.
Yeah.
My sort of final question, thank you so much, because you've been so helpful and you've provided an insight that, as I said, is very new to, I guess, a lot of our listeners. A question that I ask anyone who comes on the show, if you were put in charge of the ICC and you had complete control over the game of cricket, what changes would you like to make, whether to the rules, whether to the schedule?
To the rules, none really. To the schedule, one, I would scrap any test series that has less than 3 tests. No 2 test or 1-off test series. All test match series should be 3 test matches. I would try and govern the league, you know, whether it's the IPL or the Big Bash or all these T20 leagues that are being played. I would want the ICC to take over them, control that schedule, and probably make club cricket, T20 cricket, you know, have all the teams have an equal say within the Champions League, and you know, have bilateral tours for test matches, have 5 test match series for the Ashes already do, but England and South Africa are playing a 3 test match series, I believe. It should be 5 test matches. You're playing for the number one spot and you're giving them 3 test matches. It's the most awaited test series in a long time. and you don't have a five test match series. Pakistan, India should be five test matches, Australia, India should be, and then maybe cut down the bilateral ODI tours, let the World Cup happen, let the Champions Trophy happen, but bilateral tours should be test matches, and these leagues need to be taken over. Every country should have one T20 league, and their champion should be playing a Champions League the way it happens in football. And I think that will only happen if ICC takes control and it's not left under the hands of BCCI or Cricket Australia and so on.
Thanks for joining us for the 34th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. We look forward to joining you again very shortly.